The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2023. This is now the seventh night, and there are four streams coming up. Later on, Lower World Diaries, then Myth of the 20th Century, and then Endeavour. But first, it is UK Column, who are a regular on Millennial. They've been on quite a few times before. Brian, would you like to just quickly introduce to anyone who doesn't know what UK Column is?
Well, UK Column is an independent media outlet. We've been going for quite a long time. I embarrass myself by saying I can't quite remember when, 2009, I think, or sometime around then. We were initially a print platform, and we produced a hard copy newspaper called the UK Column. In fact, I'm going to say it's interesting how the world goes, because probably our content was not dissimilar to the light newspaper as it is now. But we eventually got to a stage where we felt that we could do more, cover more, and be more up to date by going to a social media video stream. So we now produce a news program, usually about an hour, three times a week. That's on a Monday, Wednesday and Friday. We also do a lot of interviews. We've started to do a lot more panel discussions, which have proved very popular. And really, we are commenting on the areas that the legacy media, as we should call it now, doesn't want to go. So we're generally getting into topics which either are being propagandized by the mainstream media, the legacy media, or we're covering areas that they clearly don't want to discuss. And I'm delighted that we've got Alex Thompson here, who's been with us for a very long time and been one of the key news presenters, and is producing his own material as well. And Ben Rubin, who's joined us recently to come in and be one of our news presenters. So I think we've got a pretty dynamic team, and I think we're allowed to say that we've broken ground on a number of topics, of which probably the one I would mention is that we did a lot of detailed work to expose the damage being done by the vaccination program during COVID. And I just mentioned Mike Robinson, who's my long-term friend and colleague from UK Column, because it was his work on the so-called yellow card database that enabled us to put a lot of information on screen for people to search the government's own data on adverse effects. But we've done a lot besides that.
All right. Excellent. And Alex, would you like to briefly describe your own perspective of UK Column?
We're the people who started by talking about what was happening to children. That was the biggest and deepest taboo. And he's a modest man, but Brian must have the credit for that, because he staked his reputation on it when we didn't have any reputation. And he was sticking his neck out alone among certainly his retired military officer class to do that. And the concentric circles have continued to expand. If you start with the realization, whether or not you're talking about ritual abuse or mere, in inverted commas, merely organized powerful people having their wicked way with children, both equally disturbing and wicked, if you have accepted that this happens and that there is documentation for it up to including English courts, more rarely Scottish courts, but you know, the Western courts generally accepting that this happens, then you have lost all faith completely in those who rule over you. And so we had developed in the interim, in the last decade, geopolitical expertise, both by the existing presenters, who were no slackers in that regard, Brian and Mike, the founding duo, military and defence expertise, financial expertise, a reputation that we will be solid and respectful of whistleblowers and sources. And unashamedly, recently, we have got what's often called for short, Middle England on board. And we make no bones about that either. We are not snooty, but we particularly are keen for people who, by their brain power or by their commitment, not by their upbringing or wealth, have got the ability to see, particularly in their jobs or from their expertise in their jobs, what is going wrong with the country, how we are departing from our constitutional principles, another one of our key strengths, and we'll welcome them on board. And I can jokingly say young Ben here, because for once I've got somebody a bit younger than me in the core team, is a fine example of that, together with another regular presenter who, together with Ben, has just started being a regular face, even from our studios in Plymouth, though Ben and Charles Mallett do have to travel substantial distances to Plymouth to do that. They don't live in Plymouth, unlike Brian and Mike, because Ben was a hotshot management consultant at Ernst & Young, EY. He'll tell you more in a moment, no doubt. And Charles Mallett, not with us this evening, was, and he'll, I don't know whether he'd wince at my bigging up his establishment credentials, and I won't go through them all, but he was a household infantry officer and at one point a deputy equerry to Her Late Majesty. So when we've got men of this calibre saying, I was at that level in the establishment, they've done better than me with merely having been a GCHQ desk officer for 8 years, and they will come along alongside Mike Robinson, who was a hedge fund guy, Brian, who was a retired Royal Navy officer, and say these older gentlemen are quite right, and you know, we will express it in our own idiom from our own angle with our own voices. That is quite a powerful combination. Now, I've majored there on the presenters, but we have a whole network behind the scenes now. We have a proper office staff. We've got a very active community that we're keen for people to be involved with, so the UK Column community forums. And I have to say, we've got, a full service. We've got the video content, we've got the written articles to a high standard. The editing and the content, I'm very prepared to say, is better and more fearless than what you'll find in the Telegraph, or if you cast your mind back 10 years ago to when UK Column was just starting out, Telegraph blogs were a lot of people, as the enemy would put it, were radicalized. We're ahead of that.
Not exactly a lie, though. No. I mean, I first saw Morgoth there. Right. He and I first encountered each other on Telegraph blogs.
So, some people will be thinking, what's all this reminiscing? But really, 2011, 2012-ish, when we were in the nightmare of the Cameron Clegg administration, and dear Brian was waking up with a vengeance to, I'm sure we'll talk about this more later, Israel having its tentacles all over the British government. At the same time, Telegraph blogs wouldn't quite go that far or throw a rock in that particular pond, but they were all there. And my favourite example is good old James Dellingpole, another one of these plummy public school and Oxbridge boys, who has gone so, again, to use the enemy's or the government's terms, is so radical in his truth-telling now. He's just been on a two-hour Dellingpod with me, having said, I paraphrase, what a blind fool I was back then when I was merely talking about wastes of money. Now, Alex, please tell us where it's gone wrong in the church's attitude to Israel and the Jews over the centuries. And isn't the Church of England a bunch of Satanists? So, again, I don't revel in the outspokenness for its own sake, but we've got a whole cluster of people.
We're not adolescents. We should make that point. We're not saying this stuff just to be shocking.
The whole point of having an annual review like this of the whole truth movement is, how far have we come? And one of the things that we can gloat or thank Providence for is that we've got lots of quality people, and not just the middle-aged, middle-class men either. We know we've got people from all walks of life and around the world, let alone the country, coming on board now. But the key point, I think, about UK Column is quality and sources.
Yeah, definitely. Ben, would you like to introduce yourself and how you view UK Column, your own perspective on it, and how you joined.
Absolutely, yes. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here. How do I view UK Column? So my background, which Alex just touched on, I worked in the consulting industry. He mentioned EY. I was there for a little while, but I've worked at various other places, and I don't place them on the highest pedestal. I think that, you know, they're just a big corporate bureaucratic beast, really. But they acquired a company that I was a director of. And then I began to work there. I was there for a couple of years after that. And then I've done other bits of strategy and creative consulting work. And a lot of that is, it's like commercial intelligence, basically, and a lot of cultural intelligence as well, because you need to understand what's going on in the market, what's going on with customers, what's driving their behaviours, and what are they reacting to, new technologies that are coming in, new different types of commercial models that your competitors are using that are changing their expectations about what's going on in the market. And you know, reading the FT every day for 15 years, pretty much, and just getting into the rhythm of it and understanding where the information is coming from and how it all fits together, and advising people how to operate in that complexity, basically. You know, I was doing that fairly happily. And then I started to realize that a lot of the long term consequences of what was going on in particularly as it related to technology. If you played it out 5-10 years, so this isn't good collectively, right? And actually, a lot of the things that are starting to really bubble to the surface now with things like artificial intelligence, you've got Tony Blair sitting at Chatham House basically saying, yeah, you know, we're going to roll this out. The state wants to roll this out. One of the impacts of that is going to be that we destroy loads of white and blue collar jobs. But hey, we're going to do it anyway, right? I mean, they're quite vocal about saying this stuff out in the open. That, because I was so embedded into that paradigm and understood the interconnected sort of threads of the technology and everything that they were building. The fourth industrial revolution, basically, I was immersed in that whole information ecosystem, was advising clients on it, like how to build in that space. But when I really began to think about it, it didn't make sense. I became very suspect of it, and particularly a lot of the stuff going on around the health system. And I was working at, you know, top level of big private healthcare providers in the UK, and I can't talk too much about the specifics, but I've been in and around the top levels of the NHS my entire life, really, because like a bunch of my family are senior clinicians, like very, very senior consultant clinicians. So, you know, I've been immersed in that culture around the dinner table as much as anything else, right? You know, as well as sort of venturing around it professionally. And in order to do the kind of work that we were doing, like the big transformational strategic programs, transformation programs in industries, you have to be rooted in a proper understanding of what the hell is actually going on, because there's so much complexity. But to make intelligent moves and investments and operate in that space, you have to be obsessed with truth, really. I mean, you want to get as close as possible as you can to an objective understanding, unvarnished raw data from the front line of what's actually happening, so that you can then do the most valuable thing, like what's the next step based on what we know is going on. And there's been a very obvious war on truth. I spent a lot of time as a media analyst, like within what I've just described to you, like media was a big focus. And I worked on digitization of a lot of the big mainstream newspapers in particular. Yeah, like the big UK ones, and got into the guts of their businesses and saw how the journalists operate. And we're introducing things like video pod, I can't remember what they're called, microsites. So back in about 2005, 2006, like the very early iterations of moving the newspaper online, I've been embedded in that all the way through. And I could just see like the holes in the narrative and the way that the whole thing was set up, and particularly how the incentives work around how they get paid, how these new technology platforms like the Facebooks and the Googles have completely rewired the way that information flows around society and is delivered to the populace. And seeing in the corporate world, everywhere I turned, it was like I'm actually in opposition to everything here now. Like I disagree with all of the big trends that are happening. I can see the vested interests at play behind the scenes. And essentially, the whole stack of economic activity needs to be rebuilt, right? Like across most of the major industries, the financial system, like all of it. And I can't do that over where I was because I kept getting fired, basically, for saying, or, you know, not quite to that extent. But like, it was very difficult for me. And there were a couple of things where I pointed out the people being racist and they weren't the right people to accuse of being racist. And then that ended up with me not being able to work for that company anymore. That happened to me, right? So I guess it's cancellation, right? This happened to me two or three times now because I've got a big mouth and I'm a rough diamond firebrand, according to Alex Thompson. He just said a minute ago before we came on camera. So, but anyway, like I wanted
to. It sounds like a very interesting career you've had.
Yeah, it has been. Yeah, I've been really lucky. Like, and just sort of curious, basically. I was just curious and just want to get into everything and to look at how the whole thing fits together and to create value, right? And to have a positive impact. Like most people are motivated like that. Most people, even in the corporate world, like they're actually motivated in a really positive way. And the things that they've been directed into doing, they actually believe are the right things to be doing because the people that are controlling the sort of macro narrative have done a great job of propagandizing them and making them think that this is what's required. You know, all of this new climate tech that's going to come in is going to save everything. It's like, no, it's really not. But you don't know that, and you're probably quite young. And you know, like, there's a lot of very chipper, up for it, like I was 15 years ago. You know, like a lot of people coming out of Oxbridge and you know, getting given highfalutin positions in strategic positions in big companies and the consulting industry and that kind of thing. It's like, but you've got a very singular understanding of this bit of information, and you've been G'd up to think that you're like knowledgeable and can advise people, but actually you don't know enough. And I think that it just, yeah. So anyway, so I'm rambling on now here.
That's okay. It's often a good way for someone to introduce themselves is to ramble.
I spoke out on a couple of things at the start of this year. One of them was about Genomics England, which is a UK government technology program, which is designed to capture and analyse and manipulate the DNA of the entire population, potentially the global population, actually. And I did essentially like a kind of whistleblower on that. And I did an interview with James Dalrymple, which completely diverted me into a different direction of my life. And then I started blogging on Substack, like a lot of people have. And then over the past, that was only sort of 6-7 months ago, it was April this year that I did that. And then basically I've been meeting lots of very interesting people and was already aware of UK Column, but I did a couple of interviews and wanted to see the quality. Alex has just talked on the depth and the quality. I think that's the thing that really stands out to me about UK Column, right? It's very, very, very serious information. And
there's an almost unique sense of integrity about UK Column.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's rooted in where it started off, actually. Like Alex was saying with Brian's amazing work around, you know, issues relating to children, like it doesn't get more serious than that. And if you do that kind of work, then you take that incredibly seriously because you understand how profound it is and how important it is. And that, I think, just imbues everything. We need voices that are focused on the truth, the solidity that we need is to come together and progress as an effect. Yes, we need that. Yeah, the noise.
Yeah,
of typewriters.
I'm holding up this, which I'm just about to start reading. Lance Morrow, The Noise of Typewriters: Remembering Journalism. And there's a wonderful image for fellow typewriter enthusiasts there of a lady with a Hermes ambassador, the doyenne of big desktop typewriters, usually used by diplomats and journalists. Because that book, of course, it's an American perspective, but it applies equally to Fleet Street, which physically and figuratively has disappeared and been replaced by midwittery of the kind Ben's talking about. It's not the generation that's themselves that's at fault. It's what Brian would call the reframing of the mind, and we're relentless on the lies and foolishness of the mainstream media. They've gone. So we're perfectly happy to say we will be the new BBC, despite the three orders of magnitude difference in scale and probably six orders of magnitude difference in funding. We'll do that. We'll be the Daily Telegraph, the Sunday Times and whatnot. And I can't say who, but I've been told by someone very high up that I think the number two at the Sunday Times in the editorial chain recently said at a dinner, oh, yes, we're well aware of UK column. But then that's not the first time, is it, Brian? You know, you've told it before, but the Daily Mail has you know, ripped, I think, 11 pages of our stuff directly in terms of newspaper pages on the modern common purpose.
Well,
and afterwards they said, you know, you understand we can't credit you.
Right. Well, I've still got the letter from Paul Dacre. In fact, it's feet away from me because after I sent him information, he was the then editor, and I sent him information about the work of Common Purpose. This was all the time at the sort of Leveson attack on the press, and I got a two-sentence reply, but thanking me profusely with a great big proper wet signature, and I was so impressed I had it framed, and I've got it on the wall here. So I sent quite a lot of written work all about this organisation, Common Purpose, to Paul Dacre, because he was, I could use the expression, being shafted by this crowd. And he didn't reply immediately, but eventually I got this letter thanking me for sending the information. And then whatever it was, a month or 2 months later, to my astonishment, on a Saturday morning, Common Purpose was on the front page of the Daily Mail, and the front page, and another 10 and a bit pages inside. And there was also material in the Daily Mirror, the Telegraph, a little bit in the Times, and I think one other newspaper. And probably 85% of the material they used had come from research from the UK column. So the Daily Mail certainly knows about us, but the Times had a good smear campaign a little while ago where they revealed their absolute crass ability to write stories, because they wanted to smear me, but they did it by very crude placing me alongside pictures, my picture alongside of individuals I'd never met before. We did give them a run for their money over that. But of course, if you want to tackle these people, you've got to have huge sums of money to go into a court on matters of slander and libel. And then are you going to get a straight judge? So who knows?
All right. Well, that's more of an extensive introduction than I was planning, but I guess it's it always happens that way. No, it's fine. It's fine. So let's get to 2023, because we do this every year. We talk about the year that has passed. I do it with quite a lot of guests, but especially UK Column, because of your, what UK Column is. So let's start with Alex. What would you say? Should we do this chronologically? That might be too difficult. I don't know. Alex,
maybe thematically.
What would you say about to start us off with this on the year 2023?
Right. Well, I'm going to give a polite boot up the backside to some of our sympathisers, first of all. It's definitely the year when some of our sympathisers went back to sleep. Our particular peak of interest and funding, and I make no bones about talking about funding, because we've just outlined that we've grown bigger than most of the dissident media in Britain, and therefore we have a full office to run. So just to keep the thing ticking over and churning out the content, we have a regular need for subscriptions, as does everyone. The one men and one women suppliers very much too. But people, you know, I'm not having a personal whinge here because it's happened to other content providers. What seems to have happened here is, you know, people quadrupled their support during COVID, particularly when Brian put out an earnest plea for those resources. Because we thought that the government was going to turn the taps off there and then. Now we've perhaps woken up a bit more to the fact that they're unwilling and unable to do that. You know, famous last words, but I don't think that's going to happen overnight anymore. But, you know, 2 years after most people were released from their prison lockdown, a lot of them have either got complete news fatigue or thought, well, I don't know which of the poly crises is going to hit. Is it going to be bioweapons? Is it going to be nuclear war? Oh, hey-ho, you know, I'll just go back to sleep. And a lot of them are just nervous and burned out. So I do have sympathy for them. But that's one of the things that's definitely happened. In terms of world events, obviously the huge one is the Middle East war, because it has riven families and, in the broadest sense, truth movements and groups that managed to stay united through COVID, Ukraine and various other things. And of course, your particular background, ethno-nationalism, there were some very earnest and bitter disputes on all of those issues too, as you remember, Colin. But in the end, the movement survived. I'm just talking about the ethno-nationalist part. But here, well, I think it's not so much affecting ethno-nationalism because it's a question of the Jews. So, you know, got it. There's a historical angle there. But everyone else, the churches or the members of churches who've woken up, the members of mainstream political parties who are getting disaffected, they're all excommunicating each other, disfellowshipping each other over questions of, you know, is Israel the utterly evil party as a nation? Is Hamas the utterly irredeemable party? Is it to be equated with the Palestinians? People have lost their gumption over that, you know, and I'm not just blaming the people all the time, because this is a steadily encroaching generational churn and mind-emptying operation bearing fruit now, that people who, you know, were taught to use their nous by school and family are getting older on average. So a bit of a downer, but that's I think, how I see the year in its biggest terms.
Yeah, there's certainly a decline in cognitive analytical ability, let's say, among the public. And I think that would naturally be blamed on the education system, but I think also just the culture. The culture is moronic, and you can see this just by comparing. I mean, I'm into vintage television, and you can compare it with, even game shows. And I'm certainly not a fan of game shows, but you can compare them from the 70s and the 90s with today. And there's absolutely been a decline. So I think everywhere people are encouraged towards cretinism and shallowness. So, I mean, that's a very common lament to make. I think it, but it never ceases to be important, relevant to what we are doing, because we're desperately trying to understand the world, but get the public in general to care that they live in a very corrupt world. Until it affects them personally, I think most people, it's very difficult to get them to care. Almost impossible, actually.
Oh, and we have I won't take too much of the other two guys' time, but we've got a sneaking sort of share of the audience now that's, okay, it's becoming a more of a bugbear of mine, as people can tell. They consume us for free. What's even worse, perhaps, is that they are passive in their consumption. They listen to us, and I'm not meaning disrespect to any of our commentators, but their attitude seems to be, I'll listen to them yakking on, I'll get what I want from it, and then I'll rant to myself. I won't do anything about it. We've always been keen to encourage, you know, proper activism. I mean, proper in the sense of badger your member of parliament until you get them to explode or admit something. That is declining. People weren't brought up with it anymore.
And also the ability, just something as precise as the ability to write a letter to your politician that he will take seriously.
It would take a few minutes of your time, especially if you create it on paper or print it or whatever, which is a better for impact, of course. And people think, can't really be bothered. So they've worked out how they can coast along in many cases, listening to our podcasts, perhaps while commuting or ironing, while nobody knows what they're listening to, reading our stuff furtively, perhaps in reader mode so that people can't see from the side of the device's screen what website it is. These are tactical measures that for which there's obviously some justification often, if you're, you know, especially if you're logging on in or near work. But what I mean to say is, you know, fewer and fewer other people, such as, I forget her surname now, Brian, but Elizabeth, I can't remember, the lady who at the very end of her life in 2009 wrote to the Queen directly and said, you've broken your coronation oath, you know, and made a big fuss. And I think directly on that campaign, she was imprisoned, wasn't she? Because she withheld her council tax because she couldn't, to anyone's satisfaction, get the council to prove that it wasn't being used for unlawful purposes, particularly foreign wars.
Brian, would you like to chime in there?
I would. I'm going to very Well, what do I want to challenge you a little bit, Colin, because as you talked about the dumbing down of people, but you talked about it in very general terms. You absolutely agree with you. This is what we're seeing, is that people are, without question, being dumbed down. Our children are being dumbed down. But this is not an accident. This is not an accident. This is absolutely a coherent policy that's been unleashed on the general public. And it's got a number of components running, but those components are broadening out and they're also accelerating. So we're getting to the stage where, yeah, we can talk about people who seem to have switched off. But in reality, what we're starting to see is people that have lost the ability to think for themselves. So they will give answers to particular questions, which are really just sound bites of information which they've picked up from the mainstream media. So at the moment, if you look at what's happening across the country, we've got a nation state which is being brought to its knees by a mixture of absolute raw propaganda, together with multiple programs which are using applied behavioral psychology in a political sense. We might take the government's behavioral insights team to be the lead on that, but now we've got a number of other think tanks and many charities that are using applied behavioral psychology. Plus, we've got the use of sheer pressure. We've got the fear factor, which is ramped up over everything. It might be that we're going to die because the Russians are going to nuke us, or it might be that we're going to die because there's a new variant of flu coming online, or we're going to die because we won't be able to get the treatment we want in the NHS. So we've got the fear factor being pushed on us. And also, we live in a society which is increasingly unstable. You don't know what's going to come in next. So can you drive your car to work? Maybe not, because you would be forced to go through one of the low emission zones and your car doesn't meet that. So we are seeing the whole of the nation state subjected to psychological pressure to create stress, fear, anxiety, and that is to make people more susceptible to the reframing. And maybe some of your audience will say, well, that's quite a claim, but for me the evidence is overwhelming that the population of this country, both adults and children, are being attacked by our own government in the first instance.
Ben, would you like to give your opinion there, because I see you nodding your head to what Brian's saying. So would you give your perspective? Hold on, I've muted you. Hold on.
So you talked about a dumbing down. I think that's certainly true. I mean, and you know, how many column inches have been written about that over the past few decades, right? So I think that's you can't argue with that. I think that there's a lot of apathy as well. So people who think that they can just coast along and someone else will sort their problem out and they can just ignore it and go off and do what it is they want to do, whatever, you know. And a lot of people's, what happens day to day, people's lives is fairly trivial, actually. You know, how they occupy their time when there's all this stuff going on around them. So there's a lot of apathy. And, you know, within that, I think the idea that people don't think that they can change much, basically, that the system's just bad, it is what it is, we'll just ignore it and try and work around it, and I can get on with my day and my life and kind of and be okay, you know, that mindset is pretty prevalent. But then I also think people are just fundamentally demoralized, and I think that they're finding it really difficult to ascertain what's true. You know, like because the mainstream media is gaslighting them, us, you know, and the politicians, and they're really good at it, and the amount of just there was this, I've got a screen grab somewhere from like from 2020 or 21, something like that. And it's two news stories on Sky, and they're published within 3 minutes of each other. And one says this about COVID, and then the other says the complete opposite about COVID, and they just present them like that. And it's from the same media organization. So they deliberately, even within their own narrative, you get the conflicting stuff going on between the titles, but it's what the titles themselves do within their own story as well that makes it just really, really difficult for people to navigate what's actually happening. And that's obviously done deliberately, and it is. It's a process of demoralization and destabilization of the populace and ultimately the nation. You know, on which the nation resting on the population, ultimately, and the thing that I'm there. So you asked for like the kind of hot topic from the year for me, and I completely agree with what Alex and Brian have already touched on. But it's AI. It's this new algorithmic technology and its capacity to wreak havoc. Actually, that is. That they're sort of very excitedly talking about very publicly, and you can see how this is beginning to play out, and you know, and it's in the narrative, but it's also in everything else, you know. And I think that seeing how that whole thing, that groundswell of public awareness, and how the narrative has been moved through the year, and all of this regulatory discussion, and how that whole thing has been stage managed, I think that's been really fascinating to watch.
On that point, Ben. How about this as a working model of the overselling of AI? People have been sold broad AI, artificial general intelligence. If people don't know about that, it's on Editor's Choice on the bottom part of our homepage at the moment, a big interview with two world experts on AI. They've been told, you know, AI that will think and feel, but all they'll get is narrow AI, artificial sort of specific task intelligence in a closed environment. If you drill down further, what's often called AI for marketing isn't even narrow or should we say dumb AI. It's merely algorithms.
Yeah.
And what's shoved as algorithms, I was speaking to a source the other day that made this point emphatically, is not, despite the fact that it's a weird and wonderful Arab name for a mathematical concept that only algebraists knew about until the computing age, algorithms are just flowcharts. That's all it is. AI running everything, yeah. Flowchartization, which means that he who writes the script in the back office or the planning wing of the world order is simply selling this as computer says no, but it's his flowchart that's causing you not to get your treatment or to whatever else is being blamed on AI.
Yes, and that's Palantir. That's what Palantir is. It's just flowcharts. I mean, obviously, it's more complicated than that, right? But the back end system of it, when you look at it, like the interface and how you build the logic structure and the way that it breaks up reality into these different components, where he calls his ontology, it's like he's sort of put this computer game overlay across reality, and they can just come in and intervene with it, and that's the view that they want, is that sort of system level, system operator view of everything, right? And that's what those algorithms have the potential to give them, or they think they do anyway. They can't, because reality is too complex ultimately, right?
The point that those two experts said in the interview, and at the end of it I was left with the impression that the Palantirs of this world, and there's Peter Thiel involved in Palantir, isn't it? He's famous for the expression "competition is for losers." In other words, he only wants stitch ups with government, public private partnerships. So they're the little men behind the curtain. You know, they would love to be able to say, and here we can use any kind of sci-fi connotations that you know British intellectual writers seem to lead the world in, like Douglas Adams talking about, you know, the answer to the question of life, the universe, and everything being 42. And he wrote that in the 70s, didn't he, with deep thought. And when the boffin said, "We've been waiting millions of years for your stupid answer," the computer says, "Well, you asked me the wrong question." Yes, you see what's going on there. It's just that they would love to be able to say that the planetary brain has decided you're not fit to live, at least not live comfortably and well and righteously and freely. But no, it's their script that decided that.
There was a phrase that Ben used a few minutes ago, that the idea of the nation resting upon the public. I think that's actually a key thing, that the powers that be no longer see, they no longer see nations as important entities in themselves, for one thing, but they also no longer see the nation resting upon the public. They now see the nation resting upon their systems, and the public are very much a passive element here. Receivers of services, consumers of products, but not anything, and certainly not people of national importance. The state does not depend on them. It doesn't need them. And even the economy, we could be moving into an era where even the economy doesn't really rest on the public anymore. So the public are politically irrelevant and increasingly culturally irrelevant, because the culture doesn't come from them anymore, and even economically irrelevant. Brian, I think you're wanting to speak. There you go.
Yeah, well, I did, because, you know, we get to the point where it's rock in the pond, isn't it? So I suggested that we were being governed by a government that essentially is attacking its own people. And now you're starting to describe how our importance and our right to live is being stripped away from us very, very quickly. So they're using a variety of tricks, aren't they, to get rid of the nuisance of individuals. And that is to increasingly drive participatory democracy, where we are going to have a voice through a group which the government creates. And if you want to participate in your local community, you have to join the appropriate group, and then that group will represent your voice and put the policy through, supposedly to higher level. But of course, the trick is that all the policies are coming down from top down through the system, and we're being told how we're going to live our lives. A lot of that's coming directly from the United Nations, but we've also got the World Economic Forum. And we get clues to the fact that our governments are no longer really in control, but it's higher globalist powers. Keir Starmer must take the biscuit for this, when he calmly said, when asked, which do you prefer, Westminster or Davos? He said, I prefer Davos, because at Davos I can get things done. So
yeah, and this, they're more open to ideas and exploration and so on, whereas Westminster is a closed shop.
Funny, isn't it? He's sounding exactly like Dominic Cummings there, isn't he? Yeah. Who's thought to be his nemesis, because he's thought to be, almost by some, thought to be a dissident right thinker. But when it comes down to it, they're both wanting this fresh input of ideas, but they won't specify the sources.
Yeah. And, if we want another hot topic example of the fact that we're now living lives in a decaying nation state where the control is coming in from a globalist agenda, we've only got to look at this sex education policy for young school children, which is coming in through largely the channel of UNESCO, where young children are being taught that they don't know what sex they are, that there's no such thing as a simple man and woman, and the children themselves are being highly sexualized. So where is that policy coming from? Well, many people think, well, it must be coming from the Department of Education. But of course, that's utter nonsense. It's coming directly in from UNESCO and the UN. And that policy, in most cases, is completely circumventing Westminster. It comes directly into local authority education levels and then straight into the schools. And for me, this is one of the most poisonous, because, of course, once these psychopaths have destroyed the brains and the sexual identity of young children, they are in control of that future generation, and they've destroyed the whole fabric of who we are and who we want to be and what our core values are. So people need to really be watching out for the policy agenda that's being set by the World Economic Forum, through Davos, even through the G7, G8 vehicles, because this is where geopolitics is being created and that is subsequently enforced on what's left of the nation states. And just before I shut up, I got to say, and we should be watching our new king incredibly carefully, because of course he was crowned. He went through the coronation on the lie that he was going to serve the United Kingdom. But where does his allegiance now lie with Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum and climate change and saving the world? And the fact that we've seen in the last few days Charles getting very excited that some sculptor has offered to produce a statue of him where he's got wings as if he's some form of angel. I think we're into some really dangerous, dangerous stuff.
Sorry to talk over you, but the sculpture is actually called Saviour of the World. And Charles was told that and, you know, replied, that's fine, not in literal terms, but he replied, I'm very touched. You know, what kind of megalomaniac and coronation oath breaker, who's supposed to be a servant of the people and above all of God, accepts having an idol made of him?
Here's a question, that because this has come up quite a few times, and I'm curious about what the three of you would say. And it's a bit controversial, but, you know, I think we're all used to that. There are a set of people in my sphere who say that the World Economic Forum, there are two claims here, that the World Economic Forum is in itself not important. It's not, it doesn't have power. It's a talking shop. It's a networking instrument. But it doesn't issue laws or commands. That's one thing. I'm not terribly interested in that matter because I don't think it really matters one way or the other, whether it's a talking shop or a source of power. It doesn't matter. What interests me more is the broader question. There's a lot of people in nationalism believe that there is a Jewish lobby, international Jewry, who control the world to some extent. They dominate the institutions, the media, the banking sector, academia, politics, lobbying, etc. And obviously, I'm certainly not going to deny that there are a lot of Jews in those areas. There's no question of it. My question to you, the three of you, would be, to what extent is this important? To what extent does this constitute a power block, as opposed to, or in contrast to the power block that you talk about, the World Economic Forum? Basically, I'm asking, to what extent do you think it's true that the Zionists, Jews control the world? And to what extent do you think it's true to say that Klaus Schwab rules the world? Brian, you take that.
Can I have a go at this one? Because, boy, this is hot topic stuff at the moment. So I just put it in context. Until, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago, I'd never come across anything like the Jewish lobby. It wasn't in my frame of reference. It was only when the first thing I discovered, well, I was given a book, and it was a Jewish yearbook. And it was very, it's on my bookshelf. It's in one way, a perfectly innocuous book. It's about a section of geographic area of England, and it's the Jewish community in that area have written articles. They've written little pieces recognizing the good work or the professional work of some of their fellow Jewish community members. There's adverts for particularly good or prominent Jewish businesses. There's anecdotal stories. There's a little bit of religious things. And it's put together in a hard copy book. And it is the Jewish community of that particular part of England talking to each other and congratulating each other and informing each other on what they have been able to achieve. It's all very measured. It's all very nice. So I'm not suggesting that there's anything nasty in the book itself. But I was very interested when I first was able to read it, because it gave me a little glimpse into the fact that there was a culture inside the culture that I believed I lived in. And I had not been aware of this. I suppose that was very naive, because you could say, well, of course, there's people who've been here, who've come to this country from Italy, and they've been here for many years. And so there's a natural Italian network. And that is absolutely true. But I'm going to suggest that I picked up that this particular Jewish network was clearly very well developed, and it was there under the surface, and I'd been completely unaware of it. Well, if we fast forward, I then started to realize the power of what we'll loosely call the Jewish lobby within Westminster. We'll take two vehicles, the Conservative Friends of Israel or Labour Friends of Israel. And these were clearly extremely powerful lobbying groups backed by some pretty big sums of money that boasted of their ability to influence British politicians to get them to adhere to a line that was favourable or at least friendly to Israel and the political policies of Israel. And I actually took issue with that, because I wondered what gave another nation state the ability to lobby so aggressively within our political system. If we had a Conservative Friends of Germany and the money was coming straight from Germany to tell us how we should be running the United Kingdom, I can imagine a lot of people getting very stroppy. But that wasn't the case with Israel. And then we have to up it, because if we go to an organization like BICOM, British Israel Communication, I've forgotten what the full title is, I'll look that up, but BICOM is the simple title for the organization. Not only were they able to bring very big sums of money to bear to fund the Conservative Party itself, they were openly boasting that they helped individuals like David Cameron into a position of Prime Minister. So the truth is that Israel, via these organizations, what's another one in America, AIPAC, I think it's called.
That's the one.
Another extremely powerful one. We see Israel having the ability to influence politics in the West and in the US and the UK in particular. And I'm going to say, as a straightforward Englishman, this makes me very uncomfortable, because what gives them the right to lobby so aggressively inside our parliament? But the other thing I want to say is that as I dug into this, of course, I then had to ask some other questions. If this lobbying was on the behalf of Israel, or if it was on behalf of the Jewish community, what was the nature of the Israeli state, and what was the nature of the people who said they were Jewish people? And where I've got to now is to look at it rather differently. Because I look at these lobbying groups and I see they claim to be Jewish, but are they really Jewish? Are they really a political organization? You might say Zionist, or we might say it's something deeper than that. So I think there's care needed, because is the problem amongst the Jewish community, or is the problem the power of people who call themselves Jews but are not?
I think that it's always necessary to distinguish between ordinary, everyday Jews who are not terribly political and who are certainly not running BlackRock and the ones who are, because it is a very different thing. Ben, would you like to give your perspective on this matter? The WEF, UN versus Zionism kind of thing. Straight in at the deep end.
No. It's why we're here, isn't it? So you may notice I have a Jewish surname, but I'm not actually Jewish. And I think I learned more about Judaism in the last 24 hours by listening to Alex's recent interview with James Dellingpole a couple of times than I knew before in my entire life up to this point. So I think it's undeniable. I mean, you just talked about BlackRock, right? So you look at those big financial funds, like they're all run by Jewish guys. Wall Street, very Jewish. New York itself, very Jewish. Pharmaceutical industry, same thing's true. Top of the media, yeah, absolutely. And what I've been digging into recently and learning a lot more about is the involvement of the Rothschild family in the establishment of Israel, the Rothschild philanthropic fund, Yad Hanadiv, which you're probably aware of, which helped fund the building of the Knesset and the Israeli Supreme Court. And, you know, the Rothschild family are Jewish, and well, they certainly present themselves as such, right? So there's you can understand where the interest comes from, right? It's just pattern recognition, basically. So you get a lot of people who look like this, particularly when there aren't that many of them in the world, right? This is the really the most important point. If you look at the US media, for example, you know, like I think they're like 2 or 3% of the population there, something like that, and they are, you know, represented in the you know, the a significantly higher proportion than you would expect in a whole bunch of places. You know, I've already kind of talked about a few examples there. The in terms of how that obvious power structure behaves and how it and also if you go to the places like Council on Foreign Relations as well, actually I talk more about the markets generally because that's my background, but if you look into the political institutions, particularly the global ones like the Council on Foreign Relations, whose motto is ubique, which I believe means omnipresent, right? They just that's
ubique. They are
thank you for the gracious correction. I should have expected it and needed it, clearly. Then the same thing is true there as well. How that then all leads to the thing from down here looking up, because ultimately, you know, that sort of stuff's up in the stratosphere. It's still not completely clear to me how all this stuff is coordinated, right? And I don't understand the connection. Like the hard connections, which almost certainly do exist between those organizations that I've just described and those people, and then the World Economic Forum and the UN and what have you. Klaus Schwab does absolutely not rule the world. He's played a very senior role in leading the strategic narrative for the globalist agenda. That I think that's what he's been doing.
Yeah, I agree. I think he's a front man.
Yeah, completely. Yeah, I don't think the people who really pull the strings, I don't think you really see them in public, to be honest. I mean, why would they?
Yeah.
You know, like what? Why?
Yeah.
There's no benefit to them from that. And you know, you get the Larry Finks, and you know, they want to go out and be the big guy playing the big game, and you know, maybe it's just an ego thing with them, but maybe they wouldn't necessarily need to be quite so public if they didn't enjoy it so much, you know, and get so much out of it. So I don't know, but even, you know, looking at Netanyahu, his speech to the UN about 10 weeks ago now, I think, when he basically stands up, he talks about the transformation of the Middle East and the new Israel and how it's all going to change. Yeah, maybe he knew something was going to happen. I don't know. But then he talks about the great blessings of AI and genetic engineering and this great age of abundance that we're going to go into and how it's going to be fantastic. And you listen to the policy prescriptions that he's promoting. It's all the same stuff. They all essentially have the same script. And what I can't work out is who's writing the script and who's coordinating and where's it all coming from. And there are different schools of thought. And one of them is that I've heard recently, which is a bit of a revelation to me because I'm very much familiar with the, you know, this idea of a Jewish cabal. But there's a lot of people who think it's the Brits. They think it's the British who are the ones that are at the heart and centre of it and coordinating everything. And it's these poor old Jews have been swept up in this awful British conspiracy. And that might be true too. I don't know, because I don't have enough visibility into it yet. These are the things that are slowly being revealed, basically, because all of the apparatus is all the props and the staging that they had out to convince us that no, this is what's actually happening. It's all sort of falling away.
I agree.
Yeah, so I don't know. We'll see. That was a sort of non-answer, I think. But
it was a lot more than a non-answer, Ben. That was pretty good, actually.
Okay, yeah. I'm non-committal. I can't deal in absolutes, and maybe none of us do deal in absolutes out here. Like you're going on probabilities, and that's what my gut tells me about what's going on.
Can I just throw in one thing? All right, if we're saying, which I think is a pretty truthful position, we can't. I know, Alex, you're going to say something on this, but if we accept, we can't be 100% accurate as to who's really running the show. And I certainly agree with you, Ben, that the key people will be behind the scenes, because why would they make themselves visible doing what they're doing? But the other bit that goes with it, of course, is the control of money. Whatever these organizations are, and whatever they're trying to do, they can only do what they do because they all have sufficient funding. And for me, one of the things that was it said, I've lost track of the time this year, so if I've slipped a year, forgive me. But one of the things that Mike Robinson saw and flagged up and said, this is pretty incredible, was when we had the Bank of England calmly saying that businesses that did not adhere to the green agenda would be put out of business, not would go out of business, but would be forced out of business. And therefore, you saw the combination of the money power running with the climate change power. So if we want to go looking for the people who are really running the show, we've got to look at the people controlling the money. Alex?
Yes, I can tie together what loose ends there were from both what you and Ben said on that node, really. So Colin's question is, or he's framing to us the question that people perennially ask, you know, is it the supranational soup running the show, or is it the Jews? Well, Ben mentions the idea of the Anglo-American elite make it, or the Rhodes Conspiracy, whoever you want to call it, the Crown, turning the Jews, particularly the Hofjuden, the court money-lending Jews of early modern Europe, into the fall guy. And I was actually discussing this with Charles Ortel in Portugal just a couple of days ago, a good friend of UK Columns now. He's a deeply well-read historian as well as being an investor. And he has examined his British roots and studied in Britain. So he's not your stereotypical American who doesn't understand European and British history. Far from it. He's well-read. And he was saying, why is it, Alex, that the Fuggers of Oxford, who were Gentile moneylenders, folded? It seems they backed the wrong horse for Pope sometime in the mid-16th century and went under. And after that, a bunch of Jewish moneylenders took their place because there was no one else to keep the crowns solvent, because they were then, as now, about borrowing far too much. Yeah, the ethos of the particular kinds of Judaism that existed in Western Europe, both Italy and then further north later on, was not to mix it lending money. It was to live a fairly pious and self-contained life, and at the sharp end, the Orthodox end, there was self-terrorization going on. It was the Jewish rabbis keeping people in the ghettos, but there was certainly no world conquest discourse going on. And, you know, it's six of one, half a dozen of the other in terms of the culpability there. Was it that medieval monarchs told the Jews, you will stay in these ghettos, when the Jews didn't actually have to come to those countries in the first place, and they could always have done what the Jews do and move on if they didn't like it? You know, I'm not using that as a euphemism for be persecuted, because I'm talking about you know, weigh up your chances whether you're going to live happily here, which is a very biblical Jewish attitude. Are you going to prosper here or not? No, but the Jewish family stayed there. And what is the motivation or the driver that has them, first of all, having surplus capital? Well, that's their diligence. And as Ben referred to, their concentration in certain approved professions, which is both a religious and a cultural East Asian style attitude of, you know, our sons aren't going to do rubbish jobs. They're going to keep their hands clean in literal and figurative way. They're going to be in professions that have staying power. You know, it's quite a good attitude to life in many ways. So they develop this capital. Is it the Jews' own idea then to start lending those money bags to perennially broke, because they're always going to war, European monarchs? Or are they being, you know, threatened into it, as there seem to have been many cases of? Well, the upshot either way is you've got Jewish bankers. They're not the first bankers lending to the crowns of Europe. But then that does develop the habit, as I say, the court Jews, the Hofjuden, come along. And then you get the elitism in that branch, or that just little sector of Ashkenazi European Jewry, lording it over the rest of the poor, filthy Jews, as they regard them, particularly the ones that actually take the word of God seriously. And, you know, playing as sort of Arrivists, as Johnny Come Lately's, this dangerous game, mixing it with the Anglo ascendancy. And if you go further back, the you could call it the Northern Italian or the Black Venetian nobility, the Guelphs and the Ghibellines and all of these people. And I'm thoroughly convinced from my reading of history that those families are not actually in origin Jews. And I'm not just, you know, hinting at Khazarians. I'm you know, open-minded on that theory. I'm just saying that they arrived from the Levant with some very, very nefarious West Asian ideas generally. And these families take over what the guts of what had been European Jewry, particularly Yiddish-speaking, so Western European, Northern European Jewry. I know I'm talking at many tangents here, but there's so many angles to this. One book that really helped me stand at the crossroads of this question, Colin, is Fritz Springmeier and Robin de Ruyter's book, Bloodlines of the Illuminati. You know, not the kind of book you want to be seen with as a schoolchild when your friendly neighborhood prevent officer is around with a title like that. But it does ask this question repeatedly. How do you get to be, and you know, the three of us would say that it's Satan running the show ultimately. How do you get to be a top level satanic player? Is it through Jewish networks, or is it through the soup of mainly European or certainly Western NGOs, think tanks, and now supranational organizations? Well, I think that the Jews are, well, the Jews that play in this pool, as Ben alluded to, are junior partners. And, you know, they hate the majority of the Jews whom they regard as under them, and are perfectly prepared to dispense with them. And I think that, you know, this would be true even of sort of secular people in that top level, like the Rockefeller family. They think they're near the top of the show, but the old money is very much in Northern Italy, France, Germany, Britain, Belgium. Those are where the really, at family level, the really heavy clout people are that want to see a bank for international settlements or a Bilderberg group come into existence. And these are the kinds of people who hire and fire the likes of Klaus Schwab. I'll stop there. I could have gone, you know, all night on that. But okay, to give you an honest answer, then bringing that together, it is a European black nobility project that we're dealing with, and it has acquired some adherents who claim to be Jews quite late on in the game.
Bloody hell! That's a complicated narrative. Brian, are you wanting to chip in?
Well, yeah, but what I want to say is that I think this is, I know it's us, we are your guests, but I think this is a discussion many more people need to have, because we all know something is wrong. We can see the manipulation of politics on a global scale. The same, you know, take COVID and lockdown, where the same policies, the same propaganda, the same reframing, the same applied psychology was used in countries all around the world. And that shows very powerful global control. And that can only be done by having control over global sums of money. So we can all see this. So we know that there's a plan unfolding, which is destroying our lives, and it's squashing individuals under a very big jackboot. And it's, you know, I just sort of come back to a military frame of mind. You're putting information together, and we've got to the point we're saying, actually, it's not a question of is the attack going to start? No, the attack's underway. We can see the attack. We can feel it. We see the destruction, whether it's the wars, you know, Ukraine and what's going on in Gaza, horrific. And we're seeing the lies over what's actually happening. We've seen the carnage through the NHS. We've talked about the attack on the minds of our children. So we know we're being attacked, and we can see that often the plan is, or chunks of the plan is very obvious, because we can see the elements in the flow chart working their way through, that eventually you're not going to be able to use your car because you won't be able to afford to run it because it doesn't meet clean air things, just as a tiny example. So once we get to this stage that we know we're being attacked, it's reasonable to say, well, who's attacking us? And we need to have these debates about who is actually pulling the strings. How is it that David Cameron, Tony Blair can stand up and openly, well, let's take Cameron, because his statement was the worst, where he said, my loyalty to Israel is unshakable. Well, if that's true, that means that UK, us, we come second. So what does that make David Cameron? Is he Jewish? I don't think he's ever declared he's actually Jewish. But what is he?
And if we just take that thought, Brian.
Pardon?
Can you demand, can any Jewish organization demand of a Jewish person, either in Israel or in the diaspora, that they utter the line, my loyalty to the state of Israel is unshakable? No, they can't. In Israel itself, there is too much, and I'm talking about the citizens of Israel, not the ones in East Jerusalem or in the occupied territories. Citizens of Israel who are religious Jews, which is not the majority of the nation, but around half of it and growing quickly, they will certainly not say a thing, because their loyalty above all is to God in their myriad of ways of understanding right. who he is and what his words are. Jews in diaspora, you know, not just because they're Jews and therefore stereotypically are prickly or highly conscientious, but if anyone who is another Jew other than themselves or their own rabbi says, say this line, of course they're going to say, not on your life. You know, many of them historically will say, because not just because of Jewish culture, but because of the commandments of God in the Old Testament, I'm not going to put my loyalty to any foreign state above the state where I live, being Britain, Germany, America, or whatever. Well, yeah. That was the problem of, from the point of view of the early Zionists, the over-integration of the Jews in these societies. So it's a line that no Jew, either in the diaspora or in Israel, would be demanded to say. And yet here we have a Goy politician saying it. That's just one of the many strange things about it. And it's always the conservatives who say it. You know, I'll get back to your flow, but it was the Cameron turn, wasn't it, when the allegedly the Tories took over after 2010, when Cameron and Francis Maude, a very dark figure, started saying openly, we're in bed with Israel. Through all the years that Labour was running the country under Blair and Brown, for their many sins and faults, and I certainly saw it because that's when I was an intelligence officer dealing with what was then the super secret relationship with Israel, which they blew, the Tories blew. The whole point was, well, OK, we've got a majority of Labour MPs. Some of them are old left. Some of them have a very warm heart towards the Jews and don't want the Jews to be messed around with. And for all of these reasons, we do not want Britain and Israel to be looking like hand in glove, certainly not in military and intelligence matters. So on no account, reveal was the word in those days to a member of parliament, how close we are to Israel. And one of the reasons not to do so was because the Israelis were also spying on us. You know, as everyone knew, so aggressively. And all of that went by the board when the alleged Tories took over. Sorry, back to Brian.
No, well, this is the debate we're now starting to have in people. And I don't think we want to be too quick to jump to who the real problem people is. We've got to look at people and be measuring them as individuals, what they say and what they do. But let's have the debate in UK. And I have asked this openly over many years. If if David Cameron stands on a public stage, as he did, and said his loyalty to Israel is unshakable, then we are second, and he is working, or he's certainly saying that he's working for Israel. We've got Grant Shapps, the defense minister, who's openly said his loyalty is to Israel. Tony Blair is on.
He is at least part Jewish, Grant Shapps.
Pardon?
Yes, Shapps.
He is. Yes. Yeah, but he's also made that public statement. Tony Blair has got his picture on the video, which is on Labour Friends of Israel. And, you know, Alex has touched on it in the background. We've had this open declaration, not only of a partnership of our intelligence and monitoring services, so GCHQ and MI6, MI5 working alongside the Israeli 8200 intelligence unit. We've now also got that we are in a partnership, a strategic partnership with Israel for everything, including AI, crossing AI defense, and particularly the NHS. So I think we don't want to be throwing stones at people on the simple basis of saying, well, you're Jewish, you are in on this conspiracy. But we do need to recognize that there is absolutely a conspiracy taking place, and we need to ask how this thing works and who's running it. What caused David Cameron and Francis Maud to set up the initial liaison between the British and the Israeli intelligence services? I mean, do you know that, Alex? You've got a lot more experience.
Well, it wasn't the initial liaison. They were a third party for decades, which, for those not familiar with SIGINT, means, you know, somebody who's not quite in the Five Eyes Club. That's a second party, but very close to it. Limited basis of exchange on signals intelligence, because the human intelligence people are always more cagey. For example, MI6 and CIA won't by default share their stuff with each other because it's human intelligence. It's that much more sensitive in its sourcing. But signals intelligence, third-party relationships, been there for decades. That was the, you know, thou shalt not, even within the donut at GCHQ, thou shalt not. And all of a sudden, Francis Maud is blowing that. So what Cameron and Maud did was not set up anything new. They avowed the existence of these things, and it was the first of what became many spin-offs of the brand, because we live in an era now of hackneyed brands. The established trusted brand of Five Eyes, which is properly only the five Anglo-Saxon countries' signals intelligence branches, electronic espionage, that was then expanded. So there are lots of nearly Five Eyes, like the Dutch and, as it turns out, the Israelis. And there's also a Five Eyes for domestic intelligence and a Five Eyes for foreign human intelligence. None of these have any treaty basis. Only the original Five Eyes signals intelligence one has a treaty basis. But I think it's a bait and switch that's gone on there. You're familiar with this idea. Well, the Israelis are in on it too. Just accept it. And then from there, what is genuinely new from the 2010s is that GCHQ and similar parts of government dealing with electronic poaching and gamekeeping start saying, well, yes, now it's been avowed. Now it's on the table and being talked about. Now we can start recruiting young minds or talking about this in the press in order to present ourselves as a united front. And over to Ben on this, because he has a fascinating data point from McKinsey on how much of the British and Israeli establishments, not just the intelligence people, are actually intertwined now.
Yeah, so I mean, yeah, that, you're referring to the office, right? Like the London office of McKinsey is an integrated is a headquarters for an integrated UK and Israel operation. The McKinsey office in Covent Garden in London, which I only found out recently because I wrote a letter to the guy that runs the office and a bunch of other people there as well. But yeah, that's quite a thing, because geographically, well, they're nowhere near each other, right? Like physically nowhere near each other, culturally quite different. So why have you done that, McKinsey?
Above all, economically, Ben, you know, Israel, another thing Charles Ortel, nugget he gave me last week, is Israel only became an investment grade economy very, very recently. You know, it's regarded as the index of very advanced economies. I've forgotten the acronym, the one that's basically OECD.
Yeah.
It's regarded as OECD and a solvent country because of all that US aid. But it only became an investment-grade economy very recently. So any businessman, which is, you know, the McKinsey line, obviously, is not going to think of them as in the same league at all.
No, no, certainly. And I mean, a lot of the they've got a big high-tech sector. So there's a big startup ecosystem in Israel. A lot of it's built up around military-industrial complex work. So a lot of cybersecurity, aka hacking, and, you know, that kind of stuff. And obviously Palantir's got, you know, we already talked about earlier, they've got very deep roots into Israel. You know, they recruit very heavily from Israeli government, from the IDF. Cops talked about that. Alex Cops talked about that publicly. And the same is true in the health system as well. And this is one of the things that Netanyahu talked about when he was boasting about the vaccination program and the deal that he cut with Anthony Bourla to get more vaccines and more quickly than anyone else, and to essentially operate Israel as a laboratory for Pfizer, right? Which is why it's so important to be nuanced with everything that we're saying here, because you know, sort of broad brush statements about the Jews, you know, essentially the Israeli, obviously not all Israeli citizens are Jewish, but the Jews in Israel, along with all the other citizens, had it worse than almost anyone else in terms of the vaccination program and the damage. And actually a lot of what we knew from the early signals of what was going wrong was because of the data coming out of Israel. Yeah, so, as well as the data coming out of the NHS.
Is our hypothesis then that the nasties we've been tracking for years at UK Column, based in Britain, thought, ah, Israel is a kindred spirit. It has no codified constitution in a single document. It has a mythical narrative or heartfelt belief narrative among the population that they think they're one of the finest nations on earth, and their people, their leaders, can do no wrong. So in that sense, they are similar. We can start making something out of this amorphous blob. Perhaps then, to cap it off, when Cameron said his loyalty to Israel was unshakable, he was talking about whatever entity was being set up at that point or was breaking surface at that point, which has now got so far above the waterline that you see that it's run from McKinsey's perspective by a single guy.
Well, this is all very involved. But, I mean, I think it was difficult to summarize this because I started by asking about these potential two power blocks, very much globalist, secular, Klaus Schwab, World Economic Forum, UN, all the NGOs, that kind of thing, versus Wall Street, Zionist, neocon, capitalist power block. I think that the other thing is that they needn't be rivals. They could be just two.
They could both be dupes for the same thing. You know, both of them, the broad fronts, the army groups you've talked about, could have the same general behind them who may not be anywhere near the fighting. You know, because David Ellis, who was our defense analyst for some years and had a particular focus on the BIS, the capstone of the financial and arguably the government pyramid in the whole Western world, the whole world now, including Russia and China, let no one be naive on that. David Ellis's very useful catchphrase, analytical summary on the Bank for International Settlements is, it is a shield, sorry, other way around, his catchphrase on the EU and NATO as they were becoming, he was one of the early prophets of that, a single blob thrusting eastwards. He said, this is a shield for a bank. So it's both of these organizations that we love to blame turned out to be, in his analysis, defending something that's just a couple of hundred yards over the border into Switzerland, which is not in the EU or NATO, and which within even that nation state has diplomatic immunity. And it suddenly occurs to me, Colin, as you know, rehash the question for this evening, which of the two wings is in the lead? Maybe neither, because the, should we call it Jewish capitalism or Jew-friendly capitalism of Anglo-America that you outlined, could equally well be a shield for a bank.
All right. Okay, well, I guess the That was where we're going to get towards the Gaza conflict, but I think we've kind of touched on this already. I'm trying to think what else there is to ask about this year. This has gone in quite an unpredicted direction, this talk.
Colin, I think if I just force it a little bit for this year, just look at what the world has been subjected to, particularly the Western world. But this horrific conflict in Ukraine, with hundreds of thousands of troops killed, I believe that the Russian total now will be over 100,000 men killed without any question at all, but horrific, horrific losses on the Ukrainian side that our media, our Western media, simply doesn't want to talk about, and UK Ministry of Defence has been lying its teeth off over Ukrainian success as their troops have been slaughtered. But that war into its 650-something day, I've lost track of exactly how many it is now. And then on top of that, we have this vicious fighting unleashed in Gaza, where, yes, Israel was attacked and Israelis died, there's no question of this, but the response has been to lock millions of civilians into an urban area and then to starve them, deprive them of water and bomb them and kill them. And apparently it's okay because it's Israel doing it. This has placed huge stress on the mind of people in UK and the Western world. And we have seen once Gaza exploded, we saw people starting to behave really strangely. I've never experienced anything like it before. So if we dared to say that we thought the bombing of civilian areas and the killing of civilian men, women and children in particular, was utterly wrong, we received some pretty unpleasant emails from people, particularly calling themselves Christian, who seem to have no concern for the death of children at all. So who, if we look at the people who unleashed these wars and the reactions, they've got to be absolutely in the frame. And before he goes out of my mind, let's mention Boris Johnson, because it's now widely reported, you know, across Eastern media, but also Western and US papers, that Boris Johnson played a major part in making sure that Ukraine did not achieve peace with Russia. I mean, it's just incredible that we would have that man running around. What did he do? He helped create a conflict where who knows how many people are dead and maimed now.
On another battlefield, what you just described there, Brian, is analogous to what we were discussing a few minutes ago with are Jewish conspiracies in the lead or other kinds of conspirators? Because at the time of the failed ceasefire negotiations in early 2022, people were not getting a bee in their bonnet where they should have been about Boris Johnson. They were more concerned with the Jewish Ukrainian oligarch Ihor Kolomoisky, at the time living in Israel, exiled from Ukraine because of naughtiness he'd been up to, and saying he's the real handler. And I'm not disputing the discounting the theory, but the idea was he's behind the Khazarian mafia's plan to vacate the territory of southern and eastern Ukraine and repopulate it with alleged Jews who are not Jews in the argument of the theory. That's where the focus was at the time. You know, Kolomoisky was supposedly Zelensky's Jewish puppet master. And, you know, in hindsight, although it was staring us in the face at the time, and to give ourselves credit, we were reporting it at the time when few others were in the West, it was Boris Johnson who was absolutely saying, yet, no peace with Russia. And now people from Zelensky's own cabinet have come out and told Ukraine's own people in Ukrainian, on Ukrainian state media, that was the case.
Yeah. I mean, it just seems telling, ironic that Boris Johnson is so often compared with Winston Churchill, who I would say similarly ensured that war happened a long time.
And similarly, always short of money because of certain foibles and propensities,
yes.
And often having to go to a gentleman of Jewish extraction to bail him out. Yeah? So that doesn't make the Jews automatically top of the pile. It means that we have a particularly weak and unsuitable prime minister in both cases. Now, people might gasp that I think Winston Churchill was a weak man, but I think he was.
Mm. Yeah. Well, where would you see this developing? I mean, do you think that Gaza is... Do you think that's... Well, I should ask this to Brian, since he has military experience directly. Would you see that conflict spreading geographically?
I'm going to say... I don't think it is going to spread, not in the apocalyptic way that many people think. I think that the US basically said to Netanyahu a week ago or thereabouts, you've got about another month to finish it. So he was giving the Israelis permission to carry on flattening Gaza. And I think there's no doubt that Netanyahu's view is that once Gaza is completely flattened and he's killed as many Palestinians as he possibly can, he's got a chance of holding Israel together as a country. But I think it was pretty clear that even the Biden administration was now getting cold feet over the damage that the carnage is doing to U.S. Reputation in the Middle East. So the Americans said, we'll continue to give you the bombs. You got another month or month and a bit to get Gaza flattened, and then you're going to stop. And I think that's happened because the U.S., for all of its propaganda and bravado, that it's still the big military power and the policeman of the world, has actually realized, particularly as a result of the fighting in Ukraine, that American military power around the world is rapidly moving into second place. And I absolutely believe that. And if your audience want to know why I believe that, it's because up until very recently, the last few years, it has been America's massive aircraft carrier power. They could put a carrier anywhere in the world, which meant that they had probably brought in twice the size of the average air force in order to dominate an area. But the Russians and the Chinese have now fully demonstrated that they have the weapon systems, the hypersonic missiles, to take out these aircraft carriers. So although Biden has postured by putting the Gerald R. Ford, I can't remember the other carrier that's gone out there, but there's two of them together. So although the US has postured by putting these carriers out in the Eastern Mediterranean, actually they are sitting ducks should the Russians want to do something about it. And the Americans know, they just daren't admit it to the world. So they're playing the tough man at the moment, but actually they know that their day is over. That's how I see it.
Ben, would you like to chime in on that? The decline of America, do you think, do you have any thoughts on that?
The decline of America, yeah, it's been, I'm a big fan of America. I describe myself as a constitutional conservative, actually. Like, if we had the US Constitution in this country, I'd sign it with a couple of amendments, mainly to do with term limits. But I'm a big fan of the US, and it's been railroaded into some appalling things, unfortunately, just like a lot of other nations have, including our own. The talking about what's up in the stratosphere again, actually, and while I'm thinking about it, this idea that, you know, we talk about the idea of the 20th century being the American century, but actually, was it the American century? You know, is America just the engine room, the economic engine room, or it certainly was for a good 100 years for a global empire, you know, that exists in places like the Council on Foreign Relations, for example. You know, and they present America as it's this nation and its people that are the driving force behind all these policies. But actually what we're doing, we've effectively enslaved them, and we're using their economic output to do the things that we want to do. So I think that maybe you're seeing the decline of what we've been told is America, but actually isn't. And you're going to see ascendance, actually, from the American people. And I think you're going to see that in this country as well. And actually what's collapsing is you know, it's not just American, it's an ancient international empire. It's got its roots into the British Empire as much as anything else. A lot of the stuff that we've been talking about with COP, for example, is being pushed out into the Commonwealth, which is basically, you know, the old colonies, right? It's the same power networks. So it's these global networks that are collapsing, and underneath it, I think there's going to be a wave of new growth. And I think America is going to bounce back. And I think that the UK, that England is going to bounce back. There's going to be a lot of pain and a lot of shouting in the process. But I'm actually quite optimistic about the prospects. Maybe in the midterm, less so the short term. But the West is going to be okay, I think. If that answers your question.
Yeah. I mean, I do get the feeling that America just isn't as glamorous, isn't as confident as it was, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, for sure.
Definitely not.
Yeah, the spirit seems to have been seems to be absent now.
Alex, we think about it in the 80s. Sorry to just chime in, but I'm an 80s kid. Right? I was born in 81, so I, you know, like Americana was just imbued in everything.
Yeah,
you know,
the Goonies and the E.T.
Yeah,
and all of it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that just sort of vibrant optimism and self-assuredness. It's like, I really detest it. Like when you get this kind of progressive liberal point of view where they like to see the nation unsure of itself and being undermined, and they think you deserve this, it's good to see you on the decline. And I don't think that I would never, you don't want to see people doing bad. I want to see people doing well. I want to see them thriving and confidently pushing themselves out into the world. And that's what that's certainly what we were told about America back then. And that's what it felt like. And I would love to see it get back to that.
Well, Alex, what would you say about the decline of America? Is that something that's largely imaginary, or is it a real thing?
The economy is on the way out. The politics is on the way out. The people are not. Whether or not some of them secede, which they have had a habit of doing before, and they got all these good habits from the British, as well as their constitution from us, the people will certainly continue to have the get up and go. I doubt that's true of many parts of Europe, actually. I mean, it's also a big trend in ethno-nationalism to predict a horrendous race war in America. And there will be, call it a low-level insurgency when the economy goes is probably understating it, because for those in it, it will be apocalyptically horrendous. But it will, like most of these things, however unspeakable at the time, quickly resolve itself, if only because, you know, one side will have died or moved out and something will replace it. And given the nature of the people and the territory and the heritage, the intangible heritage, it will be the best of the white man or of the old world, I think, that we will see in the whole of North America, the other side of this. You know, and to just on that point that Ben correctly made on an empire steering an empire, the CFR as the American branch of Chatham House, doing the Anglo-American establishment's bidding in American foreign policy and controlling all these secretaries of state since the war, the clearest example is right at the midpoint of the American century, the 20th century, which is 1950 plus 3 years, is the Korean War. And America, of course, has just cleared the battlefield of all its enemies and bankrupted them and wiped out their militaries, and even the military facilities are rubble. So it's at the apogee of its power. And what does America do when its opponent in the Korean War, China, is using men with spades and knives to fight it? It gets on the blower in the form of Dean Acheson to General MacArthur and says, the Brits have told us you have to lose this war, so you will contrive to lose it, please. That's best documented in Ian F. Stone's book, The Korean War, republished recently in the Hidden History series, I think it was. So that's the clearest, or the refined example to me of America doing someone else's bidding.
I mean, I can imagine people coming up with counterexamples where Britain was subservient to America.
Suez, for example, '56, or Grenada in '83, where we thought we had a special relationship between the White House and Number 10 both times, and the president in each time said, "Sorry, you know, this time the Pentagon decided what to do."
Yeah, exactly. So, Brian, would you like to summarize where we are today compared with where we were in the middle of 2020, at the heart of COVID? How do you think the world in general has changed? Speak in very broad terms. You take it away.
I'm not sure I want to be asked that question, because I have to say that I think we've declined significantly. The world, UK as a nation state, the US, the EU was hit unbelievably hard by what they did in the pandemic. So they weakened the population physically. There's no question of this. They've left disastrous vaccine residue in millions of people, which is going to adversely affect their long-term health. And they killed off a very, very large number of elderly people who should have formed at least the backbone of our societies, and with all of their knowledge and life experiences, a generation has been wiped out. And on top of that, we've got people who are incredibly fragile because they were frightened witless by lockdown and the virus COVID-19 scare. And on top of that, we've then had huge turbulence. We've got these world conflicts. So many people are scared stiff that there's going to be a nuclear war. They're worried about what's going to happen in the Middle East. And we've got this huge attack on our minds. So I unfortunately believe that we're in a very much worse state now than COVID. And I would be saying, to, if I may, to your audience, I think you really need to pay attention to all of the techniques that are being unleashed against us to attack our minds. Now, if you don't know what the Behavioural Insights team is in UK, you need to find out. You need to look at the Cabinet Office document Mindspace from 2010, which boasted about the government's ability to change the way people thought and behaved. You need to look at the UN's policy on behavioural change in all of its globalist agenda. And why do I push this? Well, it's very simple, because, they attack our health, but if we've still got our minds, we can at least do our best to improve our health or mend ourselves. But if they take control of our minds and we lose the ability to think, then we are gone. And it's very clear that the main weapon being used against us at the moment is mind control. You can call it propaganda or neurolinguistics, but it is an attack on the way we think. And then fear and anxiety are being used to condition people so that they are more vulnerable to those applied psychological techniques. So I would say to people, I think we're in a very, very dangerous position at the moment, and we've really got to stand up and say no. Let's put in a bit of lightheartedness. I decided over the Christmas period the UK column would put out some interviews with women, because I've been impressed at the number of women who've got guts and are standing up and speaking out, particularly warning about this dreadful sex education of children. So I've been particularly impressed with women, some of them tiny, who are standing up and challenging the system. And I've interviewed them as gutsy women. And at the same time, I'm saying, where are the men? Because if you meet me, I'm not a very big bloke, but I've had my head above the parapet now for 15, 16, 18 years. And I'm looking around and saying, come on, where are all the big, tough men? So I think we're in a really, really serious position, and we shouldn't underestimate it. But do I think we've got the wherewithal to do something about it? Yes, I think we have, because I think there's something deep inside ourselves in this country, but also in other countries, where the good people will stand up. And if social media is doing its job, it should be encouraging everybody to fight, however simple that is. Write a letter, say no, warn a friend, cause a bit of trouble in the right way, but it requires people to stand up and be counted.
Yeah, that's a good answer, a very good answer. It reminded me of a text that I read. It was shared, written on 4chan, I think, and shared on Twitter a few weeks ago. And someone said, compare 2023 with 4 years ago. Imagine somebody telling you in 2019 what would happen within the next 4 years. The scamdemic, BLM, Ukraine, Israel. Things of that magnitude used to happen maybe every 10 to 15 years. Now they happen every 2 years. The people in the streets look absolutely defeated and dead inside. Everybody's on edge and ready to explode like a ticking time bomb. Everything is hyper-politicized. Everything and everyone has an agenda. Harmless escapism isn't viable anymore as everything is subverted by some kind of agenda. People don't act normal anymore. Everyone seems off. Compare the current day with 10 years ago. Just watch a video of people interacting with each other from 10 years ago. It seems like a distant alien world. Yep. And then like, everybody is constantly screaming into the void. There's no civil debate anymore.
Yeah, and people have actually pinned it to the year 2014, so exactly 10 years ago as of this new year, as being the time when American and European university campuses started to be taken over by the screamers.
Yeah, and also when I started my YouTube channel.
and smartphone penetration began to hit above 70-80% of the population.
See, in 2014, it was Colin who couldn't imagine that he would ever feature in Nick Lowles' finest publications. But 2024, it's Ben's turn to look forward to his inaugural write-up in State of Hate.
Oh.
Well, look, I think the only...
I didn't tell you this was part of the deal, Ben.
Well, I don't know. I looked up Millennial Woes on Wikipedia, and you're very controversial.
So oh, God. The thing is, that page is so... ridiculous. It's designed just to make me look bad, you know.
Jimmy Wales is on the board of Nesta. Did you know that, Brian?
I didn't know that. No,
Jimmy Wales is on the board of Nesta, right? Yeah. Who owned the Behavioural Insights team.
Nesta is, you know, as the acronym suggests, it's the nest of all the British government funding that goes into the NGO. Yeah.
You know, I've actually had a very small experience with Nesta many, many years ago. I think it was 2004 or 5. And a friend and I were trying to make a film, and I applied to Nesta for an arts grant, which they were doing at that time. I think that was their original purpose as an organization. Yeah. And so I applied, and I got the form back, and it said, what will your project do to promote diversity and equality? Or multiculturalism. I can't remember the term they used. Yeah. Maybe all three terms. And that was unusual in those. That was like 2005. By 2015, that would have been absolutely normal and, you know, mandatory. But in 2005, it was kind of, it took me, and I remember it happening because it struck me at the time as kind of unusual. Yeah. But also predicted.
What on earth is going on?
Yeah. But it seemed to be the way things were going. So it didn't surprise me entirely, but it did seem like a step forward in the agenda. So that was my only experience of Nesta. And then many years later, I heard of them being involved in all this stuff.
It's the National Endowment for Science, Technology and the Arts. So it's a very broad brief that it's been given, and it's one of the first legacies of the first Blair government. So it's within the first year of that first Blair government. It's one of the things that was done. It was funded by the National Lottery. They gave them $250,000 and said go and wreak havoc, and that's what they've been doing. And they're now sat on about $500,000 and they're pumping out a whole load of stuff.
And another thing that Blair's year zero did, as in the actual first governing year, 97-98, was to set up what was then called QC appointments, now KC appointments, which is instead of the judiciary saying you're fit to come up a grade now, it's a panel coming together saying if you ever want to become a judge, you'll have to be a Queen's Counsel or King's Counsel now first. And we are now going to sift as a board who can demonstrate a lifelong commitment to equality, diversity and inclusion before you get up there. And the original selection cohort of 97, quarter of a century later, now is sitting on the bench. So that's why we have judges making patently ridiculous and baiting rulings, because they were trained that way, thanks to Blair.
Yeah, they put the mechanism in control right at the start. It's a 25-year plan.
But you haven't got to worry, because they're all going to be replaced by AI, aren't they, Ben? So, I mean, you know, they're already talking about that coming into the magistrate's court. So there'll be a flowchart that some psychopath has written in some very warm plush office funded by bankers that we can't quite pin down at the moment, who will bring in AI that will remove judges. So look on the bright side.
Well, absolutely. And the prompt engineers running the algorithm will be ethnically diverse young women under the age of 30.
No, there's no women. Come on, Ben.
I think Meta Chauban's been given special license. This is Ben's current research target. Meta Chauban seems to have been given special license to use the nomenclature of women, because, you know, that's useful to get them all radicalized. But perhaps once they're in post, they will define themselves as non-gender specific. I think we probably have to, I'm not the host here, but we have to think of Colin's time, because we have another millennial starting in a few minutes, don't you?
Yes. Well, this does seem like a tidy place to wrap up, so we can just do that. Brian, is there anything you'd like to say before we finish?
I'd just like to say, Colin, thank you very much for inviting us and allowing us to talk in front of your audience. I've always enjoyed it. The sessions we've done, I've thoroughly enjoyed. I'll be fascinated to see what the feedback is you get on us. And I will apologise, because we are three white males, of which I'm by far the oldest. But we are what we are, so we can't do anything about that. But I hope we've managed to inform and most of all, because it's coming up to Christmas, entertain your audience. So let us know what the feedback is, good or bad. We can take it.
Oh, people always enjoy your appearances on Millennial. You can rest assured of that. I was following the chat earlier, and it was generally positive, so that's good. That's great. Thank you for agreeing to appear. Alex, any final words before we finish?
Compliments on the quality of the program for Millennial. You're very conscientious. Not all the viewers know that, you know, you send out lots of, not pestering, but well thought out mail shots ahead of time to the guests. Please maximize the impact and keep a jolly spirit. And here's the graphics for you. So you've done all that design. Helps smaller creators even more than it helps us to keep up with the requirements of appearing in Millennial. Great collegial spirit, and I was delighted, I haven't managed to listen to it yet, to see that you've got, I would say, my favourite Substack blogger at the moment, Eugypius, who's given you a Millennial yesterday. Substack was one of the great maturings of this year, and Eugypius' writing on American and German politics is peerless, so I look forward to it.
Yeah, it was a good stream, and I agree with you about Substack. I started a Substack this year. I think that's gone very well, but that's my own stuff, so I won't talk about that. I think that the Eugypius thing was, yeah, it was excellent. You should definitely check that. It's been a good time, and as for Millennial, yeah, I've tried to expand how much it. You don't want to drown people with communications. But there is a whole system there. Ben, any final words before we finish?
I think the guys have done a fantastic job. Thank you for having us. It's been awesome. And I did just want to leave you and your viewers with one piece of news which hit my inbox just before the start of the program, actually, which is that George Clooney had COVID so badly last year that he had to direct his new film from bed while he was recovering. And someone's just sent that to me. I thought people would like to know.
Oh, dear. All right.
And they wrote 400 words on it as well.
Well, I'm sure we all send our sympathies to George Clooney.
Of course.
I just wonder how many vaccination boosters he had. All right. Okay. Well, this has been great. So thank you very much, UK Column, for appearing on Millennial 2023.
Thank you. Merry Christmas.
Yes, Merry Christmas.
Okay.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. Sometimes the old ways are the best. To send Millennial Woes some special Yuletide cheer by post, you can use the P.O. Box. Address on screen now.
All aboard.
Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word.